Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part 2.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, not quite living in a bubble yet.
I'm Ryan Lambert, and I'm hearing that the New Jersey Devils have signed freaking Willie Desjardins as their freaking coach this year.
Sean McAdoo from The Athletic.
There it is. You brought it up. Let's just talk about it first before we get to oodles of return to play and collective bargaining fun. Kevin Weeks, Hockey Insider Kevin Weeks, breaks the news yesterday that Tom Fitzgerald has politically maneuvered his way into retaining the general manager's gig that he was serving on an interim basis, which is great because the bar was set at don't ruin the team, and he had a pretty decent trade deadline.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and also, like, if you're going to have to rebuild again, not the worst thing in the world to have somebody who's familiar with the organization doing it. Well-respected guy. Like I've talked about before, like, the Brian McClellan situation in Washington gave me a good working example on how you can elevate somebody from a regime that you consider to not have worked. And it could be okay that person could take over and be a good GM. Do we like Fitzy? I know a lot of reporters do because he's a good source.
It's definitely a situation where you go, I don't know, maybe it could be, it's probably fine. And the other thing to say about it, obviously, is this, you know, him now being the GM solves that whole thing we were hearing a week or two ago about, where, he was saying, well, you might not, like, we might hire a GM after we hire the coach. And everybody was like, well, that seems insane, and nobody should let you do that. Now they don't have to worry about it. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I like Tom Fitzgerald as a GM. He's put his time in. He's been one of those candidates who you've heard discussed for
a real Jason Botterill type.
Well, that's the
a
thing.
A real Paul Fenton-esque
exactly.
guy.
Those are the two guys that kind of like that's sort of put a dent in this idea that that you do your time as an assistant and then you'll step in and be fine. But that doesn't mean that he can't succeed, and he did get a little bit of an on the job audition and seemed to do fine. I've written about this. It's for all the talk about the NHL being an old boys club. When it comes to GMs, I wouldn't say there's new blood coming in because it's not like they're going like really out of the comfort zone on a hiring like this, but there's not a lot of guys who get second GM jobs. It seems to be a kind of thing where it's next guy up, unless you're one of the really well-established names. And Tom Fitzgerald was one of the next guys up, and the Devils had him. They gave him a chance to see what he could do, and they liked what they saw. This makes as much sense as anything, especially under the circumstances where you want to get someone in place.
This is a really good point. Like, the days of courting your Brian Burks.
Yeah. Brian Murray, Bobby Clark, guys who would be the GM of four different teams in a 20-year period, that doesn't exist anymore. It's basically, there are guys, if you've won a cup, you'll probably get a second job. If you've done your previous job for like 10 years, you probably will get a second job. If you've been a GM for 5 years and you didn't win, that's probably it. It's probably one and done. There's not a lot of guys out there who are getting second chances, as opposed to how it still works in the coaching ranks, where it's very much not that way.
But let's pause on that. Like, the last three guys that were huge, big-name general managers that got, I guess four guys that I'm thinking of. You got Lou Lamoriello, who's, like, considered by some to be the greatest general manager maybe in the history of the game. You have Steve Yzerman, who went from Tampa to Detroit for obvious reasons. You had Ken Holland, who went from Detroit to Edmonton for Steve Yzerman reasons. And then you had George McPhee, who, you know, took over an expansion team after a really good run in Washington that just didn't result in a cup. So it happens.
It does.
But you're right, for the most part, it doesn't.
Chuck Fletcher was another one, but he had been GM for a really long time. What you don't see are the what you used to see are the guys who come in, do the job for 5 years, get fired, and then someone else goes, "Oh, you've been an NHL GM. Okay, you should be near the top of our list." Like there's, you know, the John Fergusons of the world don't get second chances, and it's I've written about this because it's got to. If I've noticed it, I'm sure NHL GMs have noticed it. I'm sure like the Mark Bergevins of the world are like looking around, going, "If I get fired, this is probably it." Like, I'm not necessarily getting another shot at this, and does that affect your decision-making? So,
yeah, that's
I don't know. And it's one of those things, it wasn't this way for a long time. It became this way. Since I originally wrote that piece, I mean, Yzerman was a different situation. Fletcher was right on the borderline. Maybe it's swinging back. Maybe it's, you know, and maybe if Fitzgerald fails, people go, you know, Fenton, Botterill, Fitzgerald, we got to stop looking at assistants and either go in a radically different direction or start going back to the guys that we know can do the job. I don't know. It's just, it's interesting to look and see where the pendulum is at right now, even if it's just in mid swing.
I think that's a really good point. I think if Fitzgerald fails, then we have to stop looking at assistance from the David Poyle ratio, GM tree is what you're trying to say.
Potentially. Yeah.
Fenton.
Yeah. Yes.
Rotterell, Fitzgerald. Yeah, tough look for Bill Guerin. So the thing you were mentioning and the thing that Ryan joked about off the top of the show
Craig,
is
Craig, how you doing, apparently,
buddy? Apparently Lindsay Ruff is going to be the new head coach of the New Jersey Devils. So here's what I know, because it's pretty fun when you put something out in the world about wondering openly how, you know, Peter Laviolette, who I think is the best coach not currently in a gig, and Gerard Gallant, your mileage may vary, but obviously
Bruce Boudreau
has a pretty good, Bruce Boudreau, pretty good resumes. Well, they interviewed Laviolette and Gallant. I don't know if they interviewed Boudreau, but those are three coaches that are out there in the world, and also Lindy Ruff was, and so I put it out in the world that I wasn't really all that thrilled with the idea of like Peter Laviolette or Gerard Gallant not getting this job and Lindy Ruff getting it. And it was like a beehive fell from a tree and all the bees started buzzing. Like, I had so many people reach out to me being like, "Dude, here's what happened." And they were all telling me the same story. So I'll share it with you. Peter Laviolette either priced himself out of the job or they didn't want to meet his price point. I could see both things happening. I think in the case of the latter, it's clearly because the Devils know that they're entering another rebuild, and maybe you don't want to pay a guy that amount of money
sure.
to just like babysit for a year or two. So from that aspect, you can kind of understand it. But from the other aspect, like, he's clearly I think he's the best coach available. You could say Boudreau. That's either or is fine. But I think he's a cut above everybody else. In Gallant's case, it gets a little more complicated. But I heard from a couple people that the same kind of thing that he ran into in Florida and in Vegas, where he wanted to have total control over every aspect of coaching and not have any input on lineups and stuff from hockey operations, was expressed in his meetings with the Devils. And the Devils are obviously trying to do things a little bit differently. They've got a very strong analytics department with Matt Cain and Tyler Dello. And I don't think that they necessarily wanted to grant Gerard the autonomy that he was looking for. That's how it was explained to me by a couple of different people. And so maybe that's the case, maybe not, but that's at least what's out there. And Lindy Ruff was affordable. I mean, let's be honest. Like, that's one of the reasons why Lindy Ruff is going to be the head coach of the Devils, is that he's going to cost less than Laviolette and Gallant. The Devils are a bad hockey team that will not be good for a couple seasons. The Devils did not make a lot of money this season, I don't think, necessarily, and probably won't next season because the team is going to be bad.
Nobody's allowed to attend their games. It's probably going to be
nobody's allowed to attend their games. That's true, too. The owners of the Devils want to, like, buy the Mets or whatever. I don't know. But, like, he was a cost-effective move and a veteran move. And I guess my only question is, besides why Lindy Ruff, and Corey Massasik, our good friend from The Athletic, has been putting out there in the world some, you know, fairly impressive stats from his run in Dallas as far as their offensive numbers. Lindy's got this reputation of being a defensive lockdown guy, but maybe that's not necessarily the right reputation to give him.
My only question is, if you watch the fucking Rangers this year, right, folks?
Come on now, Adam Fox, he did something there or whatever. But the thing that bothers me is that if you're going to just get a placeholder for this team, unless you really believe that Lindy Ruff is like the defenseman whisperer and like he can turn Ty Smith into Scott Utermeyer or some shit, like why not just give the gate to Alain Nezzardine for a couple years? Like who cares? If you're going to have a write-off for a couple seasons and hiring Lindy Ruff kind of feels that way. I don't know about you know anybody else on this fucking podcast, but it kind of feels that way for me. Just keep the guy you have and say we're fucked for a little bit and go from there. I don't know. That's sort of my take on it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think anybody watched the Rangers this year and said, now this guy, this guy who's running their defense, he's doing a great job. You know, like yeah. I think that's a fair thing to say, and I think that, when he was the coach in Dallas, I don't think anybody was looking at that Dallas team going, this is a team that defends really well. They were, I feel like, viewed as a team that was going to win a lot of 5-4 games, you know? Mm. And, do the Devils have that kind of personnel? No. So there's no Jamie Benn. Like, I love Nico Hischier, but, like, he's not Jamie Benn or Tyler Seguin in terms of offensive numbers. And, you know, maybe Jack Hughes becomes that 2 or 3 years from now. But, I think the big –
Ooh, yeah.
The big – I think the big thing you got to say about Lindy Ruff is, like, when's the last time you went, oh, yeah, he was – the guy that shepherded this really exciting young player into the league and they were super successful and blah, blah, blah. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head, that's for sure. And so if you're doing the rebuild coach thing, which I think is a reasonable step to take with the Devils, they're not going to be good for a few years, regardless of who's coaching them. I really don't know like why Lindy Ruff is that guy, other than, as you say, he came relatively cheap because he's currently an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jamie Benn was 25 when he won the Art Ross under Lindy Ruff, but he had been in the league for
quite a while. Like 19.
He wasn't. Yeah, he didn't break in under that under Lindy Ruff. So that point holds. I was a little bit. I don't love the hire, especially given the other names that are out there. I mean, if you're a Devils fan and those bigger, probably almost certainly better names are out there, I can understand why this feels disappointing. But I was a little bit surprised at the amount of pushback I seem to see, and maybe this is just me being on Twitter and getting a different slice of what the feedback was, but there seemed to be more pushback than I thought. Like, Lindy Ruff is a good coach. Lindy Ruff he's coached two teams, both of them fairly successfully. Other than the bad year in Dallas that got him fired, you look down this guy's resume, it's all for like 40-win seasons, 50-win seasons, 90, 100, 110 points on granted some good teams, but, you still got to get them there. He's 60 years old, so he's certainly not some young up and comer, but he's, you know, that's well within the range of what NHL coaches tend to be. And he last coached in 2017. Like, some of the feedback makes it sound like they pulled this guy out of a crypt somewhere and he hadn't coached in 20 years. He was a coach 3 years ago. He was a very successful coach 4 years ago. So I can understand why if you're Tom Fitzgerald and you're new to the job and you've got young players, you're a new GM, there's probably going to be a lot of new faces just in the organization. I can understand why you'd want a steady veteran hand for this job. And again, the Peter Laviolettes of the world would have fit that description too. But I get it. You know, as far as why not Alain Nasruddin, I mean, just like Tom Fitzgerald, he had half a season to show what he can do. Maybe they saw it and they weren't feeling it. Maybe they didn't feel like that. You know, he didn't do enough, not just in terms of results on the ice, because the roster was obviously a mess by that point. But you know, maybe whatever they saw made them think that this isn't our guy going forward. So you know, obviously if I'm a Devils fan, I'm hoping it's going to be Gallant or Laviolette or Boudreaux. I don't hate this, and I'm surprised at the level of animosity towards it that I saw from some corners.
It reminds me of when Lou Lamoriello would just kind of throw a veteran coach in there and just see what happens. But we'll see. I mean, listen, I like with the Mackenzie Blackwood thing, which I was very wrong about, I'd love to be wrong about this too. I'd love for him to come in and transform a bad team into something respectable. I'm one of those Devils fans that was a little bummed it wasn't one of the coaches that was available. That was a little bit of a higher cut of a stake, it is what it is. I will say though that I think this is another check in the column of hockey nepotism. In the sense that Tom Fitzgerald played for Lindy Ruff for a few seasons in Florida, like 20 years ago. Too, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's just and it's funny. Like Andrew Walker, I don't know where he's even on the radio anymore, but he took a run at me last night, and his hill to die on apparently is just because he played for Lindy Ruff doesn't mean he should be disqualified. I'm like, he shouldn't be disqualified. I'm simply pointing out that yet a fucking again, the old boys club churns out another, you know, random connection that ends up with somebody getting a job.
I think that's maybe a little unfair to say, just in terms of, if you're a coach who's how many guys in the league has Lindy Ruff coached? And so the real problem is that, like, the only people who get hired for any jobs are ex-players, for the most part, right? And so, like, you're going to end up, you know... It's the same thing of, oh, you know, he coached this guy in junior, blah, blah, blah. Like, everybody coached every coach has coached 50 NHL players, and statistically, one of those NHL players is going to end up running a front office.
Oh,
somewhere. That's
completely right. So, no, like, it's completely that random. It's completely random that Peter Laviolette, Gerard Gallant, and, like, Bruce Boudreau never coached Tom Fitzgerald, but the guy who did got the job. It's kind of weird. It's weird, really wild.
Do you think he's like, you know, fuck. A quarter century ago, I was really feeling what Lindy Ruff was selling
me. Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right.
I don't understand what. Hold on. You are the first person to always point out the old boys club bullshit in this league.
Right.
But this is the exception.
No. What? No. I'm saying that, like, you can draw the little lines from A to B on, you know, just about every hire in the league and.
Right, because they're all nepotism. That's the point. Like, that's the point I'm trying to make. They're all guys that knew a guy in a former job. Fuck, Tom Fitzgerald got two jobs because of Ray Shiro. Like, it's all that. That's what this is.
All I'm saying is 25 years is a long time for him to go, you know what? Putting aside everything else we've learned about Lindy Ruff in the last 25 years, he was nice to me. When I played a season and a half for him on the Florida Panthers. Like, I don't know. I think just in terms of
it's
all the other stuff you said. All the other stuff you said about Laviolette wanting too much money and Gallant.
Guy makes a good Guy makes a good impression. You follow his career for the next 25 years. You're like, you know what? That dude was really solid when I played for him, and he's become a really good coach. And if I ever had a chance to hire him, I bet I would. That's all it is. It's not because, you know, fucking Lindy Ruff got him a coffee one day in Sunrise. It's merely that he has a personal connection with the guy, probably followed his career, and was like, hey, this dude's available. I'd love to work with him.
I just think it's more the stuff you said about Laviolette was too expensive. Gallant wanted too much input. I don't know why he did or didn't interview Bruce Boudreau. I just think that, like, to say that his principal reason for hiring Lindy Ruff was he coached me for 88 games in 1994, I think that's a bit hard to believe. Versus all the other stuff you have said, which makes a lot more sense to me on the hiring decision front.
I would hope it's not. But again, like no one's saying it's the principal reason. It's never the principal reason in any of these things. But it's a factor, and it's always a factor. And we're basically arguing the same thing, which is that it's a constant churning mill of the same names over and over again. And part of the reason why is because of hockey nepotism.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. I wish Lindy Ruff luck. I don't want the Devils to be horrible, even though it kind of looks like it might be that way.
I don't think that's a Lindy Ruff decision to make.
No, it's not. So. Like, as we saw in the second part of this season, it's very much a Mackenzie Blackwood decision. He's the only thing that's going to keep them from being fucking garbage for the next year or so. But we press on. Hey, as you're listening to this podcast, the players are voting to approve a new CBA and all the return to play protocols. It made it past the executive board. Do you boys see the graphic that the NHLPA created to announce that the executive board had passed the CBA stuff? Did you see the graphic they sent out?
Graphic design is their passion. That's
so the graphic. The best way I could describe it, Sean, is the graphic the NHLPA sent out looked like the menu a trendy American gastropub would create. God,
I'm looking at it now. Holy smokes!
Yeah, it's got all the little squares of information and. It's like executive board passes CBA and also return to play goes to players now for total body vote. It's pretty fucking tremendous. I really enjoyed it.
It's like the lyric videos on YouTube, like from 2008, yeah. Where they were getting really like, oh, I'm going to make this next screen. The font's going to be a little different.
Just so people don't think we're exaggerating, this just one corner. It says the secret ballot vote will be conducted electronically. It's got the word "the" is in a special graphic and font. Secret ballot vote is all big and bolded. Will be is smaller and underlined. Conducted changes colors. There's a picture of a ballot box in the middle of all this. And then electronically has its own font and outline and a little graphic of like a microchip sort of deal.
Yeah, it's in the
nine.
It should have been in. It should have been in the frickin' like calculator font. You know, like the digital clock font. You know,
right? That would have been sick. Do you think they did this so the players understand what's going on?
At
least the CHL guys.
If
right?
they did that, if they just wanted the player, it just would be the word escrow with a circle and a Ghostbuster line through it, and that would be it. And people would be like, "I go yes."
did Ghostbusters invent that thing? Because I hear people say that all the time.
No, wasn't the Ghostbusters symbol like the no smoking symbol? No had smoking. To predate that. No?
That makes sense. I guess.
All right, you know what, guys? I tried to make one pop culture reference, so fine. You know what?
No, okay. I was asking. I don't know.
I've seen six movies. I tried to reference one of them, and you know, you attack me. So fine.
But the Ghostbusters 2 did invent a ghost holding up two fingers.
That's true. And you can't say until
that point. Which was the invention of the peace sign. Not a lot of people know that.
Right.
That
was it was. That's right. John Lennon saw that, and he's like, oh, well, I guess he was dead by that point, I think. Forget it.
Which makes him what? A ghost. Thank you. Piece it together.
God damn it. Why wasn't there a John Lennon ghost walking through Times Square in the Ghostbusters
Maybe
reboot?
There was.
So Melissa McCarthy could shoot him with a ghost gun.
I'm not saying the ghost from the Ghostbusters 2 logo was John Lennon, but I'm not saying that.
They were at least friends. Yeah. I think we can all agree.
I've never seen them both in the same room at the same time. I'm just going to say that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, read the lyrics to Instant Karma, people. You'll understand exactly what Sean's talking about.
Imagine right, so which, Vigo the Carpathian? What in the world?
Man. We all shine on like the moon and the stars and the sun because you're a ghost. All right. What do you want to talk about first, CBA or return to play?
Let's go CBA.
All right. Brass tacks, $81.5 million cap next season. The only way it starts moving is if we get back to the revenue levels that were projected for this season. So everybody I've talked to said, possibility we have an $81.5 million cap for two seasons. And that's, I mean, that's more. Real bad.
Right. I've heard three seasons from.
Yeah, three seems. And well, because based on the way they're going to calculate it, too, it's like taking both the upcoming year and the season 2 years prior into account. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's 2 years prior and then the estimates of the prior season, yes, which would have been completed, but you don't know the revenues yet. So,
right. So like it's going to be rooted in years with low revenues for quite a while, it seems like.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like the idea that the cap is going to maybe go up like 5 or 6% over the life of this CBA is not like totally outrageous.
And it's also not completely unfathomable that the cap could stay flat for almost the entire deal, or at least to stay close enough to flat that
it's effectively flat. Yeah.
That it's effectively flat, or that the play, because I mean, it's going to start off, even starting at 81.5, the players are getting more than their 50%. And that's what they have to figure out, because they had two options. Either the salary cap drops to like 60 or 70 million and it's Armageddon for everyone, or it stays high, but now you're breaking the 50-50 linkage and you have to figure out how you get that money back. The owners are going to try to get all their money back by the end of the deal. I'm not even convinced that they will. But certainly in some view, this, from a player's perspective, they are borrowing against their future earnings to make sure that their salaries and their cap doesn't plummet over the next few years. But they're going to pay that back towards the end of the deal, which is, if you're a player in the prime of your career, that may seem like a reasonable move. If you're at the end of your career, that's great, because you might not be around when the bill comes due. If you're someone who's just entering the league, I wonder how you feel about everybody creating this situation when you're on an entry-level deal, and when your big contract kicks in, suddenly you're going to be getting a big chunk of that clawed back to pay for guys today.
Brooks noted that, you know, we could be stuck with a relatively flat cap until like 2025, maybe. Mm-hmm. And at that point, there's only like, you know, one in every 10 players in the league is signed beyond, like, up to that point, and a mm-hmm. bunch of like guys who would otherwise make an absolute shitload of money against the cap in free agency, they're just not going to be able to do that. Now we're talking like your Colton Parayko's and Seth Jones's and Zach Werenski's, Matt Tkachuk's, blah, blah, blah. Like, you can just go down the list and there's this huge number of guys where you're like, oh, that's like an $8 million player. That's like a $7.5 million player.
But the thing that he's not accounting for, or maybe he is and he's just underestimating it, is the revenue bump from the US TV deal. And
how much more do you think it's going to be, though? Like,
if they have two different networks...
Yeah, maybe if there's two different networks, but
I don't know what the situation is with mine, obviously. It's well above my pay grade, as I tell everybody, but the one thing I've heard constantly for the last few, like 10 years on this CBA that we've been on, is that the next TV deal is going to be multiple networks. So they're definitely going to that's the reason why Bettman wanted to get this thing done. Is so that they can go out and start negotiating these.
Oh, sure. No, I understand. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, we're the problem with the saying, oh, well, when Seattle comes into the league, .. is, well, then you got to start dividing all that revenue by 32 teams and not 31. And then it's like, oh, right. That's not maybe, you know,
well,
they're going to be on the higher end probably of revenue teams in the league, but
right.
Are they going to be?
But they're
going
to be able
10?
To. Yes,
you think so?
Okay. I think they are. Yes, right. I was told. I remember the day that they announced the team. somebody with one of the other teams, I was talking to him, and he's just like, this is going to be a top 10 revenue team. Like, literally said that to me. This is going to be a top 10 revenue team. And I also think that you know, part of the equation for the revenues they're going to generate is like gear sales and things like that are going to be, you know, put into the hopper too. I mean, it may not be like enough to fucking elevate the salary cap, but it's going to be a good chunk of money. But those are the two things that they've talked about internally that, you know, could sort of stem the tide a little bit on the revenue losses is the US TV contract and Seattle thing. Whether that's going to be enough to trigger the cap rising, I don't know. The thing that's going to probably trigger the cap rising is a vaccine. I mean, like, if we're being honest, yep. Right? So, but I don't share that view that it's going to be like 2024 before the cap rises again. I think it's going to be before that, but I do definitely think it's going to be at least the next two seasons.
Well, the other problem is how many contracts are built or structured. Like the example I used when I was writing the newsletter yesterday was Washington, right? Washington signed all these deals. Oh, the Nick Backstrom deal. you know, sure, it's a lot now, but like by the end of that deal, it's only going to be 7.5% of the cap instead of, you know, 9.5% and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, now, probably not. Now it's, you might get it down to 8.5%, but you know, and there's a ton of teams that are just facing like this huge cap crunch, not next year and the year after, like in 2023, that teams are going to be like, oh, we only have like $20 million to spend on 9 guys or whatever it is. And I don't know, man. I think it's going to be real tough out there for a lot of guys who are expecting to cash in at 27, 28.
Yeah,
and especially for the ones who aren't the real elite levels. Like I'm not sure how this is going to affect a guy like a Taylor Hall who has a Hart Trophy on his resume and isn't coming off a great season, but was expected to be, you know, a big time ticket. I could still see the argument that when you get to a certain level, some teams, you're not going to maybe be able to be picky about where you wind up as you would have been, but some team somewhere will find a way to make it work. But the guys the next level down, like the guys who were going to sign like the James Neal, like I'm a steady second line guy, so I want 5.5 or 6. Yeah, I mean, it feels like we've been saying this ever since 2005 that the CBA squeezes the middle class, but it's going to really squeeze on a lot of these guys, especially when it comes to new deals. And maybe that means we just see a bunch of guys signing extensions and just being like, I don't even want to go to the market, because there's going to be a lot of guys every year. And I mean, this happens under the previous CBAs too, but especially this one, like it's a game of musical chairs and there's not a lot of chairs, and there's going to be a lot of guys left at the end having to either take minimum deals somewhere or go somewhere else, because there's just not going to be enough jobs.
Do you think Alex Petrangelo is like, fuck, I should have signed last summer. God damn it.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, like,
you know,
yeah. Justin,
let the Blues worry about it.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated by the Taylor Hall thing. I've been fascinated by it for a long time, but like he's the guy that should sign a short-term deal, right? Like go someplace, try to win a cup in the next couple seasons.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people saying, like, oh, he should just go to Colorado. He doesn't have to be the star there, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Just go, Just, you've spent your fucking life, you know, on the fringes because your teams have been horrible. But he's been pretty adamant about looking for something long-term, which is completely his right. I mean, if you want to find that and someone can maneuver the money for you, whatever. But, like, I if I was in his shoes, go someplace for 2 seasons, take your, like, somewhat big money deal to go play with a really good team and try to put them over the top, and then you know, get a little bit of a long term deal after that. But I guess, you know, then you're 2 years older, right? So then what does that deal look like? I don't know. It's I really feel bad for him, to be quite honest. Like I really feel fucking shitty for Taylor Hall that he finally gets a crack at this and potentially was going to be the belle of the ball, and it happens in a situation where A, there's a flat cap, and B, nobody has any money anyway.
crazy.
Yeah.
Like, the bad luck, apart from winning draft lotteries, the bad luck Taylor Hall has had in his career is staggering.
It's staggering, yeah. All right, the escrow, we're not going to go too deep in escrow because people just literally will shut off the show.
Fans don't care about escrow. All you need to know about escrow is they figured out something that made the players happy enough to get to a deal that leads to the stuff you do care about.
Right. And but the only really interesting thing for me was the 10% salary deferral that they're doing next season, which gives the owners more cash on hand and also protects that money from being basically taxed at a 20% rate, you know. Because all the money that's collected for escrow next season is going to go to the owners, like, immediately, yeah, pretty much. So the idea that they hold on to that money and get it back in a few years, I thought was like it was like one of those moments of cooperation and logic that you don't expect to find in an NHL negotiation. But it was interesting to see. Like, it's not a rollback, but kind of maybe is. But also, you get your money back. So that was pretty fucking cool. Yeah. I didn't mind that at all.
To my mind, there's. I'll tell you the two things that I think are the biggest news on this, because I'm writing a piece that's going to go up in a few days on, like, my view of what this means for the fan, because we're going to get a million breakdowns of who wins and loses between the players and the owners and what does it mean for the bottom line and all this. I don't care. I want to know, like, as someone who watches the league, how is this going to affect things? And the number one and the obvious thing is the fact that they just got a deal done. You know, we have a new CBA without a work stoppage, without a lockout. Obviously, the circumstances are bizarre, and it's a positive, obviously, that they got this deal done. It's also frustrating in a sense because you're sitting there looking at all the previous lockouts going, really? You guys can do a CBA in like 2 weeks if you actually put your mind to it and you're actually motivated to get a deal and not. There's no time for grandstanding and all this other stuff. They just got it done. But they did get it done, and I'm happy for that. The other biggest piece of news is how little is actually changing in this new CBA. Yeah. Put the return to play aside. This is 95% the same CBA that we already had. And you know, how many things have we talked about over the last few years that the league could do? Either because, you know, somebody says, I've got an idea, or here's a thing that another league does, or here's a problem that I think that this league needs to solve. They did virtually none of that. Like, there's a couple of tweaks here and there. Entry-level deals move around a little bit. There's some tweaks around cap recapture and no trades. But it is, I mean, it's, I keep saying tweaks, that's what it is. There is not anything in here, once you get past the initial sticker shock of return to play and the fact that they got the CBA tied to it, there's nothing in here that feels like a big idea. There's nothing in here that feels like a game changer. It's 95% the same deal we already had, which, you know, in some sense, it's reassurance that, you know, I guess maybe this league was on the right track. This is still the same CBA basically from 2005. I guess that maybe losing that whole season was worth it because we got stability. It would have been frustrating to lose a season and then have the league say this isn't working and we got to blow it up again. But man, like, if you understand the CBA that we had last year, you're pretty much there for this one. There's nothing in here that registers as much more than like little small shifts here and there. As a fan, it's basically the same thing you're already used to.
I thought, and you're right, and I think that one of the reasons why it got done, I mean, obviously, I think the global pandemic greased the skids to try to get this thing done as quickly as possible, but there wasn't the overwhelming, overriding issue that the owners had that was going to cause a lockout.
Yeah, but there, right? wasn't there in wasn't 2013 late. Either, and we still lost half a season. And, you know, in 2013, the big thing was getting to 50-50, and everybody knew they were going to wind up at 50-50. And yet, we still lost half a season because at that point, that was just how this league worked. The owners had stashed some money away, and I had someone say to me, and maybe this is it, they're like, the owners, whenever it's time for a lockout, the owners stash some money away, and this pandemic means it burned through their stash. So they actually had to get a deal done, and maybe that's...
Well, it's also... I've also heard from people that they don't mind lockouts because nobody goes to games in October and November.
Well, right? I got news for who's going to games for the next year or so.
The the tweaks, though, that you've talked about are really fascinating, because I always love when the CBA comes out and there's shit in there that I had never even thought of. Like, we've had these major trades in the last few years where Erik Karlsson goes to San Jose, Matt Duchene goes to Columbus, Taylor Hall goes to the Coyotes, and in each trade, there's a conditional draft pick in play where if the player signs with that new team, then the other team gets the pick. And it never really... I always thought that that was a good thing because it's, essentially it was another bargaining chip a team can throw on the table to win a derby to get a player, right? But the PA's stance was, well, fuck that. Like, it restricts our ability to sign with that team then. It'll create, like, a little roadblock. And in Matt Duchene's case, I mean, it was a complete non-starter to ever bring him back if you were going to, you know, have to give up another first-round pick. So they fixed that. They got rid of those conditional picks, and I thought that was interesting. I never really thought of it from the other side
of
the equation.
And it is the right thing to do, because you're right. Yep. I mean, if you're you know, a star player and you get traded to a team and you're trying to negotiate an extension, and that team knows that if they sign you to an extension, they lose a first-round pick, that does put an anchor on what they're willing to offer you. And it's I wouldn't consider that a major change, but it was, I mean, there are some small details in there that are interesting, and that's one of them. The fact that they fixed the absolutely indefensible fact that players could lose the no trade clauses if they were traded before they kicked in, the PK Subban thing,
it's insane.
It's insane that it took us this to fix that, and that they didn't just look at it and go, I mean, the fact that a player could negotiate something in their contract and have it not carry over after they were traded was terrible. They sort of, I won't even say they fixed cap recapture. They changed it, but not in a way that fixes it.
Fixing cap recapture is getting rid of it, but...
Exactly. And getting rid of it and also giving the Canucks their money back from this year and saying, you know what, sorry, we screwed up. Here's a cap credit for the, you know, $3 million or whatever it was they lost this year. They didn't do that. My favorite one is that they reworked the entry level contracts and bonuses, including making more awards eligible for the bonus. You can now have in your contract that if you win the Mark Messier Leadership Award in your first 3 years in the league, you can get a bonus for that. An award that exists solely to recognize, like, old
38-year-olds
been around forever that we like.
Right.
Yeah, and, your bonus if you're a 22-year-old who wins the Mark Messier Award should be the franchise you play for. That's how unlikely it is that you're going to get that award.
So
the only way it could ever work is if, like, we had another, like, Igor Larionov come into the league at, like, 37. And he's already got the reputation of being, like, the greatest leader for his international team.
Yeah.
Then maybe he's got a chance as a rookie.
If we're talking
otherwise...
international leaders, I don't know about that. I think,
Oh, that's true, too, yeah. How many if you look back at the Messier, I think there's only, like, a few foreign guys that have ever... foreign-born players that have ever won it.
You know, Greg, I can't, off the top of my head, pull up who has won the Mark Messier Award. An award
you haven't. You don't know that
nobody cares about.
First of all, it's presented by Bridgestone.
I have heard that.
One, two, three. And they've been giving it out since 2006.
Who's the third? Because I know Alfredson and Sundin both won in the years that they abandoned their teams.
Well, who's the last one? Come on. It's a pretty easy one if you think
about
it. Current player.
Was it current player?
Yeah. Like, who's a captain and a paragon of leadership on his team?
Ante Kopitar?
Is it Ovechkin? Like,
no, it's got to be Chara, maybe?
There it is. Oh, exactly. Yeah, Chara. Zdeno Chara. Yeah. Yeah. I'll just read them for you. Chelios, Sundin, Aginla, Crosby, Chara, Doan, Alfredson, Dustin Brown. All right. Jonathan Toews, Shea Weber, Nick Foligno, Derek Engeland. For that speech, and Wayne Simmons.
I'm not going to say that for leadership. The Nick Foligno is the cutoff of when they started running out of players, but
the leader of the year. That's what it's for. Jesus Christ, that award. All right. Anything else on the CBA besides, wow, it's amazing? Wow. Well, Sean, I guess one more thing.
Sean mentioned it, but like the fact that they're like, hey, rookies are getting a pay raise. $50,000. What do you say, guys? Like, what the fuck?
I know.
Fuck?
Yeah. And the NHL minimum wage will be up to $800,000 by the end of the year.
I looked at it, and with the most recent changes that are going into effect next year, the NHL salary or the rookie max has gone up like 9% since 2005, and the salary cap has gone up 109%.
Right. Yeah.
It's bananas.
But this is standard for. Not just the NHL, but all sports leagues, they always screw over the entry-level guys when these sorts of negotiations because thinking is they're not in the union yet. So, you know, sorry, Alexis Lafreniere, the fact that they nudged it up a little bit is, I guess, something.
Let me put it this way. It didn't even keep up with inflation over the last 15 years. Like, it didn't even actually come close to keeping up with inflation, so...
Look, the big winner here is the luxury tax, because for those of us who, you know, suffered through fucking 2005 and said, you know, show some backbone, don't allow a hard cap, go for the luxury tax, you know, the players folded, they got curb stomped, they had to deal with the cap. Of course, now fast forward 15 years. The players have to basically like save the league by agreeing to an artificial cap number, because if it's linked to revenue and there's no revenue, you're absolutely fucked. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, like I saw a graphic the other day after the Pat Mahomes contract of how much the top player in each league makes, and commiserate with the NHL's revenues before the pandemic. Like the idea that the top NHL player makes. Like, a slim fucking fraction of what the top players in other sports makes is insane.
Well, it's not insane, though. I mean, this is a sport nobody cares about.
But the insane thing to me is we're sitting here in 2020, and the highest paid player as far as their annual salary is Connor McDavid at $12.5 million. Before the lockout, way back in 2005, it was Jaromir Jagr at like 11 point something. So right. The fact that not only over 15 years, but over the 15 years that revenues exploded in pro sports, the fact that the highest paid NHL player has, you know, basically had an inflation raise is crazy.
That's the cap system. Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely the cap system, which again, you know, was under the auspices of like, we need to do this to save our shaky franchises and yada, yada, yada. And I mean, there's some
players,
virtue to that.
The players
sure.
seem okay with it. The players absolutely
well,
if could have this, they were never going to have more leverage, and they absolutely could have said to the league, "Wait a second, you've spent the last 15 years telling us that you desperately need to be linked to revenue, etc. So why are we going to help you out now? Why are we going to change it around now?" Obviously, it would have come at a cost to them, and it would have meant no return to play. But they had the leverage. If they really wanted to, if they wanted payback from 2005, they absolutely could have. Obviously, they don't. And that's, you know, from a fan's perspective, that's good. You want the players and the owners to at least be partially partners. And the fact that this could have been a war, and the fact that it wasn't, it's a positive.
I think that there's a difference between being okay with the salary cap and having no stomach to fight to change it, which I think is the real issue. Like they know that essentially the NHLPA
practically there is a difference.
I think there is. I mean, I'm sure that there's probably a lot of guys who are just like fuck the cap, but they know inherently that every time they've stepped up and tried to take the fight to Gary Bettman or be in a fight with Gary Bettman,
they've gotten their heads
lockout,
caved in.
And they've gotten their heads caved in because they can't, because the NHLPA is such a, it's like the fucking, we are, you know, it's a small world of players associations. Like, you have guys from all over the world with all different senses of what labor negotiations should look like. You have all different ages of guys that are older guys, families. Same deal with talking about return to play. It is a very, very hard union to get everybody on the same page. It's this thing they've always struggled about on all these issues. Get everybody on the same page and fight for one issue. And I just think they don't have the stomach to have the fight. Because you're right. If they did, they would have done it this summer. Because they're never going to have more leverage than they
have. So this is it. That they, you know, for all the talk in 2005 about how they would never, ever, ever play under a cap, they seem okay with it enough And yeah, and look, at the same time, I'm sitting here saying they had the leverage. They could have got, if they had done that, they would be getting killed everywhere in the sports world for being. I mean, we saw what happened in baseball, and they did get a deal done. I mean, hockey, people would be screaming that this is the end of the NHL as a something that anybody cares about. If they can't get a deal done, they can't come back, and the NBA is going to play, and baseball is going to be there, and football is going to be there, and screw the NHL, we're done with it. So I completely get why they looked at each other and went, this is not the place to have this fight. But this was their one and only chance to win the fight. Yeah. The other thing we should say for the CBA is the Olympics is back, which is good. Ending the IOC deal, but yeah.
The Olympics is back, except they were definitely going to go to one of them because it's in freaking China. So all this, the big pull here is, we're going to freaking Milan, baby. Can't wait.
You know what? I'll say this. There's a reason that Gary Bettman gets his 8 or 9 or 10 million bucks a year. The fact that he was able to take something that was so obviously in the league's benefit and so obviously something the league wanted to do and turn it into a major concession,
it's a big W,
the players.
Yep.
Man, this guy's good at this. Like, this is, and we all saw it play out. We all knew exactly what was happening, what he was doing. But I saw it referenced as, they're going back to that. That's a major win for the players. That's a major concession by the league for something that he wanted in the first place. That's good negotiating. You got to give him that.
That's also good negotiating to show the IOC exactly what happened in the Olympics the NHL wasn't there for, which is that nobody gave a fuck about men's hockey, like, outside of Russia. Mm-hmm. I think they accomplished what they wanted to accomplish by skipping insofar as negotiating with the IOC. But again, like, I know Rene Fassal, as per usual, was optimistic about there being a deal now between the NHL and the IOC, but it really does come down to, like, the basic things they're looking for and whether the IOC has moved on them. I've heard they have, but it remains to be seen. But the thing I was shocked about is that the NHL had been making a lot of noise about, okay, you can have the Olympics if we get this larger international calendar done of World Cups and Ryder Cups and all this other shit. And they told me they just didn't have time to figure it out, like, during this part of the negotiation. I guess they'll do so in the larger document at some point, but I really thought that Olympics was going to be tied to, okay, give us X amount of World Cups where we keep all the money.
There's going to be – between now and the Milan Olympics, I think there's going to be at least one World Cup, right? Like, nobody's like – I don't know. It might happen. It might not. Everybody thinks that this is going to happen. They'll figure it out.
Plus, I mean, like, now with the revenue situation, like, let's do, like, fucking 35 outdoor games, like 6 World Cups. Just go batshit. Why not? Return to play. I wrote about it on Thursday in my column. I'm absolutely fascinated by all the protocols for life inside the bubble. I'm imagining pool parties. I'm imagining the hotel bars are going to be the greatest fucking scene you've ever seen, as every team goes there for post-game pops because there's nowhere else to go. It's going to be interesting how this whole thing plays out. I also love the idea of everybody piling on school buses and going on field trips to golf courses and things of that nature, which is another thing that's spelled out in the protocols.
I just can't help but, like, picture all the players, like, gathering it around a school bus and being given, like, the same colored shirts with the phone number on it. And everything. Like, it's got the permission forms, everybody.
Do we have Tyler Sagan here? Tyler, are you here?
Everybody quiet on the bus. I'm going to...
Joel Quenneville's holding up a red flag that they all have to follow in single file into the golf course.
Is Ryan here? You're all named Ryan. Awesome.
They're singing frickin' 99 Balls of Beer on the Wall. All the CHL guys need help getting there. Listen.
There it is. It's a fascinating document. As I mentioned before, like, I've been told by epidemiologists for the last few months that if you can test every day and you can make your bubble secure, i.e. don't interact with the general public in any significant way, that you could, in theory, pull this off. And as I was reading the document, I'm like, this is exactly what they've been saying. Is if you follow these rules that the NHL put in place to a T, You might be able to pull this off. Now, do I wish that maybe there were some face shields on the ice? Yeah. Do I think it's nonsensical that the 11 coaches that are 55 years and older are going to be behind the bench without masks on? Yeah, it's fucking nonsensical. But the rest of it was like the kind of in-depth thing that if you're a player, you're looking at and being like, all right, they seem to kind of know what the fuck they're doing.
Well,
on this.
Here's the real issue, I think, is they go, hey, once everybody gets to the conference finals, everybody's family is just going to show up. And that won't be a problem for anybody at all. That'll be fine, I think.
Well, it's after they quarantine, so the families will have to, like, stay in their own hotel and do nothing, or stay with the player and do nothing. But in theory, like, they'll be tested and they won't infect them.
We'll see.
But again, like I said, I love anything that the NHL steals from reality television. This is fucking what Survivor did in their first season and have done it every season subsequently. You get to a certain point in the competition and you get to see your family again. It's like a carrot. It's like incentive. It's great. Yeah. I love it.
The return to play is. I'm really not. I'm becoming less and less convinced that this is going to work, but
yeah, I don't
it might.
Think so either
it could, and I mean they're hell bent on giving it a shot. The things I found interesting in the return to play side is the fact that even though they're all agreeing to do this, there are a couple of basically escape clauses that if things go bad, not just in terms of they haven't set a number as far as if we have this many positive tests on a team or in the league, we do this. They didn't go to that level of detail, but there was talk of, you know, if it's not safe to continue, and also if the I can't remember what the phrase they used, but basically if the integrity of the tournament is
the integrity of the competition is impacted.
Yeah, I mean, each team's going to have 30 guys, so in theory you could have 10 players test positive and off they go and you still got a team, but if those are your 10 best players and we're just watching AHL teams play for the Stanley Cup, in theory there is a scenario where they could say, you know what, it's not worth it. I do think more and more that even if this is successful in the sense that we get to the end and somebody wins the Stanley Cup, I think we have to get our heads around the fact that all 24 teams might not make it through this. It is not impossible or even all that difficult to imagine a scenario where there could be an outbreak on a team where that team has to leave the tournament. And that's going to be a really bizarre and controversial and whatever word you want to put on it situation. But that could I mean, the Leafs and Bruins could be heading into their annual Game 7 and 8 guys on the Bruins test positive the day before the game.
And all the Leafs fans happened? Are finally, like, finally, we fucking did it. We beat them.
Yeah.
And they still lose.
But then, by the way, the Bruins are withdrawing. The Leafs win by forfeit. But now, also, the Leafs have just been exposed to 8 players who tested positive. So what happens to them and where does that, yep. like...
Right.
There's a million scenarios here where I feel like, and maybe this is just, I'm just describing myself, but I was too caught up in the kind of binary, like it will work or it won't. And they will play this tournament and it'll go off the way they describe, or it will grind to a halt. And, you know, maybe not. Like we could lose, like have an outbreak. 4 teams have an outbreak. And we're seeing it kind of in some of the other leagues, soccer and that, where teams
MLS,
are withdrawing
yeah.
from tournaments. And that could happen in the NHL. I don't know what you do about it other than to say, like, as fans, I think we have to start getting our heads around that this could happen and this might be something we have to deal with.
You know, it's funny. I had never really, like, I knew in my head, they didn't award the 1919 Stanley Cup because the Spanish flu outbreak. Sure, okay. What they don't tell you about that is they fucking tried. They got to Game 5 of the Cup Final, and then, like, half the players on both teams got sick, and a guy died. And they don't tell you that part when they're talking about, oh, it's crazy. They had to not have the Stanley Cup 1 year. Yeah, because the guy fucking died. And, like, it's not, you know, you hate to think of that this could happen, but, like, it's a real possibility that, like, someone could get very, very sick, have their career ended because of complications from this, and, like, we're just going to be like, ah, but you know what? Like, that he was just on one team.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That is it. Like, there's, you know, we talk about what if there's an outbreak, what if there's some team has a bunch of positives, and even in that, it's sort of baked in this assumption that we're talking.
They're
about
all asymptomatic.
Symptoms. We're talking. You know, they're all going to be okay. And A, we don't know that. And B, we don't know the long term effects. And I mean, that's the true nightmare scenario. Like you said, is somebody dies, because at that point the whole thing shuts down. There's no. I can't conceive of them moving on under any circumstances if that happens. But what happens if a bunch of guys get mildly sick and you finish the tournament and then a year later these guys all have permanent lung damage and their careers are threatened, and you're looking back going, what the hell did we do? Why did we put everyone in that situation? Why did we bring everyone into a scenario where that could happen? Man,
I'm doing the finger thing that means money.
But I mean, like, why did we do this? Why did we, like, who's we though? Because the players are going to have agreed to this, and they could easily say we don't want to come back.
We is all of us, and you know, I understand that you know, we the fans. It's not like we could have all said like don't do it, and the league would have been like okay, but you know.
Oh no, we're not the fans. We're out of the equation. Yeah, like we're watching it on TV, but we're not spending money to go see these games.
Yeah, we're out of the equation as far. Well, we're out of the equation as far as the decision making power. But you know, there's most of the fans are behind this and want to see it happen and want to see it succeed. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's not like we could all get together and say shut it down and the league's going to do it, but. I could just see everyone in a situation looking back going, how did that ever seem like a good idea to all of us?
Is it fair to say that the majority mindset for fans right now is, look, if it's there, we'll totally watch it, but if they decided not to come back, that's cool too? Or do you think the majority feeling of fans is don't come back, or do you think the majority feeling of fans is you have to come back and it's stupid not to? Do you think there's like that middle ground thing is the majority?
I don't know if there is.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I'm sure someone has done like Harris polling or some shit like that where it's like, you know, how do you feel about – I'll fucking Google it right now. Sports return COVID.
The Quinnipiac poll said the majority of fans said whatever Trump wants. Well, that's kind of weird. It's very interesting.
Crazy. I don't want to be cynical. I feel like if you want to describe a majority of your hockey fans, it's that they want hockey to come back, but they want to raise just enough red flags that if it all goes bad, they can point back and go, see, I was one of the people who knew this was going to happen. I knew this was going to be a risk. And
How's the plan in Canada? Like, if I picked up all the Canadian newspapers, like, what's the vibe as far as, like, return to play. They should come back. They shouldn't.
I mean, there's a lot of hesitancy. There's obviously up here in Canada, we're certainly not out of the woods, but we're looking at what's happening in the States. And there's, you know, there's a lot of concern, but at the same time, is there an uprising of up here of people saying don't do it? I can't say there is. I think there's a lot of people, like I said, with some trepidation putting that out in the world, but also not taking the step of saying don't do it. And by the way, I include myself in that group. I absolutely realize I'm describing myself when I say that.
Yeah, a CNN poll, and this is from May, so maybe things have changed, but a CNN poll found only 48% of 1,001 respondents believe professional sports leagues should play any games in 2020. 47% oppose a return, and 5% are unsure. So we're talking about 50-50, right down the middle, whether people should come back or the sports should come back or not. And again, maybe things have changed because this is a poll from May, and things look very different today than they did in May, but like that's the most recent poll I could find quickly. I don't think they should do it. I think it's a fucking bad idea, but... Will I watch if they do? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of my job, right?
Oh, it's not only kind of your job, but you were like fucking over the fucking moon on that schedule that Emily tweeted out this week as far as like when the games are.
Well, I mean, just in terms of isn't that what we've been saying as hockey fans
forever,
for years of like, hey, maybe they should make it so like all the games are staggered so you don't have to watch 9 games that start at 7 p.m. on a Saturday every Saturday all season.
It's legitimately one of my favorite things about covering Olympic hockey is like you get there at like 11 at the arena and then you're leaving at like midnight. Like, you know, there's obviously work around that to like writing and shit, but like what an incredible thing to be able to like roll out of bed or, you know, make a little breakfast or whatever, start fucking watching hockey and then just keep watching hockey.
Yeah, when the
not granted, like
when the NCAA tournament's happening, it's the same thing. On the Saturday of the NCAA hockey tournament, there's like six games going on over the course of 10 hours and there's some overlap, obviously, and like you're watching one game while on the computer while you're watching another live and that kind of thing. But like, you know, they stagger it enough that you that like intermissions don't overlap and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that why wouldn't that be the way you just do it all the time? I don't, you know.
I know it's fucking dumb. I'm with Sean on this. Like I think that they can come back and do this. And they could even finish it. I know that that shit in MLS and everywhere is kind of scary, but like, I've had enough people tell me that they could do this that I think that it's at least worth a chance to try. What I am worried about, curious about, baffled about is what happens when in game, you know, 3 of the first round of the round of 16, Nathan MacKinnon tests positive for COVID, right? And like, what happens then? What happens to the team? Because part of the equation is contact tracing, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you have a conversation for 15 minutes with somebody 6 feet away, which most teammates probably will, you've got to get tested. You've got to be isolated in theory. Like, I don't think the document spells out some things about how this will all play out, but I don't think I've really have a concept for how this is all going to play out. If somebody tests positive, what that means for the team, and God forbid what it means if it is like an essential player on the team where, you know, the fucking Golden Knights are in the playoffs and Oscar Dansk is all of a sudden their starting goaltender because fucking Fleury and Lehner both tested positive or some shit.
Yep.
Like, I can't conceive of that quite yet.
And you know, in fairness, I don't think we're saying that they should have every scenario mapped out. I think the NHL has benefited when it comes to the hub cities, at least, by leaving some things undecided and sort of mapping. But it does feel like there's been a shift, even in, like, it feels like when we started this whole plan, there was this idea that we had to make sure there were, it had to be a completely locked down bubble so that there were no infections, period. That was the goal. And now it's, and this isn't just hockey, this is all sports. It feels like the line keeps moving of, you know, if, okay, a few positives would be okay. Maybe a lot of positives would be okay under these circumstances. Maybe we can get through this. Maybe we can do it with that. I don't know. And I don't know where we're going to be in a month from now when the games actually start, where the expectations will be or how they're going to handle things. And by the way, we should also mention, not to go down this path again, but spelled out in that in the agreement is that they're not going to tell us anything about who tests positive. So you're going to be sitting there watch, you know, your team's going to be getting ready for game 5 of a series that's tied 2-2, and suddenly you're going to see a tweet go across saying that 5 of your best players aren't at practice, and you're just going to be expected to sit there and go, oh, maybe it's a maintenance day, I don't know. I guess I shouldn't ask any questions. So it's going to be a really bizarre situation.
It has incredible impact on wagering, which is something that the NHL has tried to push for the last year. And it's kind of stunning that they'll not be forthcoming with that information because of that. But I also think it's going to be really, I mean, look, it's going to get out. Like, the fucking Elliott's going to, you know, have that information. Maybe he goes with it or he doesn't. Maybe the rules change when we start getting
the
into
information
the bubble
is
going to
be
missing
out,
games.
But there's enough media organizations that have policies about not naming that they will stick to that.
But for me, the difference, though, is that if you stick to that, if you're not naming names or talking about guys that have it, or talking about how many guys on a team have it, you have to at least have those numbers in a general sense like we've been getting from the league, or else it is a clear case of them trying to obfuscate the truth in order to create a false sense of security about the bubble. Like, we have to have information on positive tests in some way, shape, or form, don't we?
Yeah, and maybe we still will in the way that they've been giving it. You know, it's X number of players. I don't even know if it'll be at the team level. But, you know, again, and also, what happens if, you know, what happens if some player sits out game 7 and everyone's kind of side-eyeing each other like, uh-oh, And then he comes, says, okay. And then he, the next day, comes out and says, guys, I sprained my ankle. It's a bad ankle. I didn't test positive. And then, well, okay, why aren't all the other players who are out telling us what their injury is? And now it becomes this whole thing where if certain players are allowed to share the information, why isn't this other guy? And it just, it becomes such a mess. And I don't know the answer, but it's going to be, I feel like there's going to be this very weird situation where fans and media are all going to be side-eyeing each other, but not supposed to or allowed to say what everyone's thinking when we suddenly see guys disappear off of lineups or out of practice or be away from the team.
I think the answer is in 10 years, you're definitely going to be writing a column about would such and such have won the cup if such and such didn't get COVID.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Unless the Leafs win the cup, in which case it's all completely valid and legitimate and there's no further discussion.
One more thing on the return to play, because it's my favorite thing in the document in some ways. The idea that teams are going to be tasked with keeping their players in line to make sure that they don't go to the club and then try to get back into the bubble. And one of the things that could happen is that these teams could lose a draft pick if it's discovered that players left, go partied, got COVID, came back into the bubble without anybody knowing. And Sean, you might know this, but in the CBA, there are only a few cases in which teams can lose a draft pick by the letter of the law. Violating the 50-player reserve clause limit is one. I found out that you could lose multiple first-round picks if you lie about hockey-related revenue to the league on multiple occasions, which is kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. But the thing I wanted to mention here is back in the day before Rule 48, when we used to talk about the concussion crisis insofar as headhunting, blindside hits, guys like guys running around fucking hitting each other in the head and getting Jesse Bull-Reese situations, to pull a name out of my ass. One of the solutions was maybe have the teams police these guys. Maybe have the teams say, look, you can't do this shit anymore, or else we're going to be penalized. Find the coach, find the GM, dock them a draft pick. And I find it kind of interesting that I think it's a good judge of the severity of this situation that the NHL has introduced the idea that a team could lose a draft pick if they don't police their own players. But, it kind of pisses me off that we don't apply this threat in other situations to help make the game better. Like, for example, supplemental discipline for repeat offenders. Yeah. I don't know.
First of all, I find it ironic that a Devils fan is pushing for more. I mean, don't you just get the first round pick back later, right? I mean, that's your GM just stares down the commissioner.
I bit my tongue during that fucking cap recapture conversation you guys just had. But yeah, that's the severity of the situation. So anyway, you can probably find the documents. I think they're out there. They're a really fascinating read. And I give the NHL and the PA credit for creating what at least on the surface seems like a pathway to trying to pull this thing off. But as we said, we'll only know once we get inside the bubble. All right, moving on. Wanted to give a shout out to our friend Scotty Waz, who tweeted, the Florida Panthers front office is doing great when your senior VP of hockey operations leaves to start a luxury travel company in the middle of a pandemic. Just what Chris Pronger decided to do this week. Progress got a good interview up with Jeremy Rutherford on The Athletic, talking about his decision to go to create wellinspiredtravels.com, dealing with VIP amenities, private charters, the whole thing. This is interesting because remember when Pronger kept on wearing that hat of the private plane company during the Flyers' run to the Cup Final that year?
Yeah, he was on the Flyers. What do you not get about that?
he was trying to pimp out that plane company, but now he's in the travel space, leaving the Panthers, never getting a crack at being a GM in this league, and now moving on to the private sector, as it were. Chris Pronger.
I think the best thing about it was everybody just going, good luck to him. He's a great guy. We all love it. It seemed like everybody got a memo of please say that I'm nice in announcing this deal. Very strange.
Yeah, it's the interview on The Athletic is worth reading because it's sort of it's like Rutherford is like very politely trying to poke and prod at what exactly might be going on here, and Pronger is basically sticking to the story, which is just this is what he wants to do right now, and could he basically describes that he had always wanted to be a GM, but maybe feels like he doesn't have the patience for it now that he's seen the job up close, which might be a polite way of saying that the job kind of sucks when you've actually seen someone have to do it. But he does leave the door open to coming back, so that's he could absolutely do that at some point, because I have heard people speak pretty highly of him as a hockey mind.
Yeah, I think so. And my favorite part of the interview with Jeremy was the part where he talks
up
around
in class today.
When Pronger talks around the concept of players who play for the Panthers not giving a real fuck about hockey and just are interested in going out to dinner in South Beach and stuff. It's yeah. kind of the inference that you glean from that portion of the story, but almost to the point where he said that like if you really wanted to read between the lines, he's saying playing in a hockey market keeps you more honest because the fans are always like on your ass to be better. But if you're in Florida, like, there's so much else you could be doing, and there's not a lot of fans that are, like, be better when you go out to, like, dinner or whatever.
Yeah. Which is why Chris Pronger wants them moved to Quebec.
Yeah.
Obviously.
That's why you definitely want to be in a hockey mad market like Edmonton. That's where you want to be.
And if you ever.
The other interesting part of the interview was when, like, Rutherford made a reference to, like, obviously the timing of this, and he was like, you know, there's... You guys, if you might have a shot at Alexis Lafreniere, and Pronger was like, "Yeah, that means we lost." Like it was like you could see even through the interview him getting mad at the idea that he's supposed to be excited, and it just captures what I'm convinced is the mindset of these guys. And I know fans are all, you know, there's lots of fans who are like, "I kind of hope my team loses the play-in round," but like the guys with this Pronger mindset are like, you idiot, do you understand that would mean we would lose? Like, that's not a good thing. We're not here to lose. So that was an interesting insight, I thought.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
These guys are competitive to a psychologically problematically degree. So, yeah.
Right. And also, you know, let's keep in mind that what he said, though, it is very tough to win in Florida unless you're the Lightning, I guess.
Who sell out every game for a decade.
Right, but otherwise, been in the Cup Final and almost set a record for the most number of points in a single season for a team. You know, it's tough to win. Did either of you guys watch Supermarket Sweep?
Loved it as a kid. I know they...
Do they have it in Canada, Sean?
I feel like, yeah, we did. It may be like a Canadian version. I definitely have memories of watching people like push a grocery cart around a fake grocery store, which I assume is the idea we're going for here, but it may have been called something different. And it was just a lot more ketchup chips and Smarties involved.
They bought back at least the first season of the show on Netflix. It's unfortunately obviously available only in standard definition because they didn't have HD back then. Highly recommend it, not only for the early 1990s fashions, but for the sheer joy of watching this insanely idiotic show where there's three parts to it. First, they have to answer supermarket-centric trivia questions about products, including, like, basically just, like, fill-in-the-blank answers when they start giving you letters, like it's Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah, no, I seem to recall that one of the rounds was a lot like on Dan Vega's Mega Money Challenge, where he's like, this condiment is red, and you would be wise to keep it in your head.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, no, that's so cool. I loved that show as a kid. It was a show a child could feel like, I'd be good at that.
That's a very good point. I never realized that's probably where he got the cadence of the questions from on I Think You Should Leave, because we were watching one last night because the kid you know likes it, and also my wife, also me, and Like, one of the questions was, to have a breakfast cereal, you don't have to – or to have a breakfast in your bowl, you don't have to be a baker. Make sure you get oats that are made by a Quaker.
Yeah.
The Quaker oats.
The other one that I remember was there was always a round where they would, like – it was basically, like, showing you a jumble and being like, okay, the letters on this one are D-R-T-S-M-A-U. Right. And you're like –
My daughter got one of those jumbles right last night, and she goes, "Daddy, they just spelled it backwards, both words." I'm like, "Oh yeah, they really did, didn't they?" It's just like it's the dumbest shit you can find. But the supermarket sweep part is very exciting, except for the fact that after like the second episode, people started to really sort of understand what they needed to do to win the game, which is get all the giant slabs of meat and cheese wheels.
Yes.
That they could fit in
just
their cart.
Just grab as many turkeys as you possibly can.
Right, because it's all like $20 a piece.
Yeah, of course. And now they would be like running to the pharmacy counter and being like grabbing one bottle of pills worth $7 billion.
Right. They would go to the medicine, and even back then they would go to the medicine aisle because like shit like stuff for your contact
Tylenol,
lenses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Right? So they would go there, and then they would get diapers would be their thing, and then it would be like the turkeys and the hams and the fucking cheese wheels. But I wanted to bring it up because there was an episode the other night I was fascinated by, because there was a team of two women who were like best friends or whatever, and they were on the show, and the host of the show was like, "Hey, it's good to see you again. You were on a recent episode, but we had a technical problem, and now you're back again." I'm like, this is a very interesting situation. So I Googled it for a bit, and as you might be able to glean, not a whole lot of web writing being done on Supermarket Sweep back in 1991. So there really wasn't a lot to go on. But I did find their original episode on YouTube, and in the comments, again, not the greatest example of journalistic integrity, comments on a YouTube video, but I'm going to go with this. In the comments, someone said what had happened was, in theory, that if you're doing the supermarket sweep and you bump into an opponent or knock shit off the shelf as you're getting your stuff in the cart, there's like monetary penalties that's taken off your total for the amount of groceries you've put in your cart.
Sure.
So, like, if you go and knock over like a display of you know, peas, cans of peas, they can knock like $100 off your tally, which I didn't know. And so they pinpointed a point in the video where they believe that one of these women like bumped into a cameraman or some shit during their supermarket sweep, and that might have been the thing where they got money taken off and then they didn't win the game. But I was like fucking fast. But here's the point of the story. Because there is a point. They go on and they just fucking roll through their return appearance. Like, they're killing it.
Well, because you know where everything is.
Right. But also they're getting all the questions right too, because they know what the questions are. It's season one. People didn't even know what the fuck this game was. So they go through – they've got like fucking 15 minutes to go over the supermarket sweep. Everybody else has got like 2 minutes, right? They're just fucking killing the game. So they get to the final round. And Sean, the final round is you have to run around the supermarket, and there's different like trivia questions. And the answer to the trivia question will then lead you to the next product you have to get.
It's like a scavenger hunt.
Right. And then there'll be another question, and that'll lead you to the last thing that you got to get, and that's where the money is. So – my theory on this entire show is, like, they don't want these women to win. Because, like, it's obvious they lodge some protest. It's obvious, like, well, we're going to fucking sue you if you don't put us on another episode. I don't know why Ken Campbell all of a sudden is on Supermarket Sweep. But, so, like, I feel like the whole time, you know, they had to put these women back on. It is not out of the kindness of their hearts that these women are back on Supermarket Sweep. So they go through the first two questions of the trivia question part, and then they get to the last question. And I shit you not, the question is like basically the best foreign film winner director Costa Gravis's blank is also a thing that you'd find in blank. And so you have to know the name of Costa Gravis's foreign film Oscar winner to realize they are talking about Z paper towels. And, like, they literally have 40 seconds left to try to figure out this clue. And they've got no goddamn idea what it is. Because usually the question is of the same rhyming convention. Like, you know, pick, don't be a bounty, pick a bounty or some shit. And then they literally throw a grade A last trivia question, a bar trivia style question, just to fuck them, I believe, on Supermarket Sweep.
Respect.
And I got to tell you, as a as a guy who can be pretty vindictive in life, pretty much the greatest episode of any game show I've ever seen to have that
happen.
That's
very
cool. The guys
cool.
who did the documentary on the Price is Right cheater.
Yes. Well, he didn't cheat. He very That's explicitly true. Didn't cheat. And neither did the guy who basically figured out all the patterns on
Press Your
Press
Luck.
Your luck. That guy didn't cheat.
Did you guys follow the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire UK scandal that they did the recent show on, AMC?
I've been meaning to watch that and I haven't.
It's real good, and that's another one where you're like, there are certain aspects of it where you totally believe that these people cheated. It was basically Sean. There was somebody in the audience coughing at times, and the producers of the show are convinced that the coughs sync up with the guy changing his answer on the show, and that's how he was able to win. But it doesn't account for, like, the fact that this guy also got a lot of answers right. Like, it's a very interesting scandal, and also the show is real good in leaving it a little ambiguous. But I mean, a lot of information points to there being cheating there. But I agree with you. Like, the Price is Right thing and the Press Your Luck thing were not. I mean, that's no more cheating than what Steve Wiebe did, knowing the patterns of the Donkey Kong game, right?
Correct.
Right. But maybe he changed the motherboard. That's the other thing he could have done, right? That's what they
say. That's what they say. Although they Guinness just reinstated Billy Mitchell's world records because there's no evidence that it actually happened or some shit. I don't remember the details. Anyway, point is they're rebooting Supermarket Sweep. Did you know this?
With Leslie Jones, right?
Yeah, host Leslie Jones.
Yeah, and I just saw they're rebooting The Weakest Link with Jane Lynch, which... I mean, Jane Lynch is always can play the stone cold bitch that you need to be the host of The Weakest Link. But I also think that there's sort of a winking acknowledgement that she's probably a pretty cool person. So you need someone. Someone who works for the Trump administration to be the host.
Kellyanne Conway, or Kaylee.
McInerney,
because who was the original host? Like, it was some
British lady,
yeah,
some school marm. Yeah,
do you know who came in second for that hosting job? Who apparently was the runner up? Richard Hatch, who was at the height of his Survivor villainy. Apparently,
wow,
the other guy that they were going to put in there as a guy who could be the jerk, and also, you know, this was the whole reality thing. I remember seeing that somewhere. At the time.
Yeah, that's when we were all really hungry to find, like, people like Richard Hatch and Simon Cowell to be mean to people on reality shows.
Yeah, I don't know if Richard Hatch would have been naked for the entire episode. Yeah. That would have worked.
It's the only thing I remember about him at this point. I didn't watch that season of Survivor.
The thing I remember about Richard Hatch, it's a life lesson. His whole thing was, I know that I'm a son of a bitch, but he knew two things inherently. That if he kept on catching fish, they'd keep him on the show because they had to eat, right?
Sure.
So his talent was like going out in the water buck naked and like spearing fish so they could eat. So they kept him around because of that. And his whole thing was in the final – and Sean, you probably remember this. In the final tribal council, his thing was, I know that you all hate me, but you have to admit that I played the game the best.
Yeah,
and that was what turned Susan Hawk, was it, I believe, into voting for him.
And his, like, infamously, the very, very first episode of Survivor, where nobody knew anything that was going on, nobody had any idea what was going to happen, they're interviewing Richard Hatch on the beach on day one, and he looks around and he's like, I'm winning $1 million. He's like, I know how this game works. None of these people do. They're all trying to like make fires and stuff, and I've already figured out who I'm going to align with and just destroy everyone. And he was like, and they put that on the show, and people were like, yeah, well, clearly that guy's not winning. They wouldn't have given the ending away, and then he won.
First season of Survivor, for the record, Lambert, is fucking great. Like, it is every high art.
Let me put it this
show.
Way: every time I've ever seen an episode of Survivor, I've gone, oh, that seems pretty cool. And like, I'm confident that I saw episodes of season one and was like, oh, I like this, and then never really followed up on it. I have one reality show I watch, and it's freaking Top Chef, and it sounds like Richard Hatch, a real Brian Mullarkey scenario.
No, he's a real Marcel type guy, really full of himself.
Okay, okay.
Well, by the way, all the episodes,
did Marcel win? I don't think Marcel.
No, he
won.
Did not win.
So
no,
sounds like not really.
All the episodes,
although I guess Brian Mullarkey didn't either.
He didn't. All the episodes of Mise en Pod, by the way, available on the Patreon if you want to listen to me and Lambert and Ruby break down this season of Top Chef that just passed. All right. Speaking of game shows, Sean, I believe you have one for us this week.
I have a quiz. I am not going to oversell this and call it a game show by any stretch. This was a low effort quiz that I put together.
Oh, well, I mean, ones that you and I create are low effort.
Also for you guys. So this is based on a piece that I wrote last week because we haven't had sports in 3 months and I've been completely out of ideas for what to write about since April. I wrote a piece where I tried to build the best roster I could out of players who were not the best player in history to have their own initials. So this was guys like Mark Recchi, who had 1,500 career points, but was not as good as Maurice Richard, or Glenn Hall, not as good as Gordie Howe. You get the concept. So what we're going to do this quiz is we're going to take turns. I'm going to give you guys the name of a solid, dependable NHL player who may very well be the second best player in history to have those initials, and I want you to tell me the name of the best player in history with those initials.
And this is by point totals?
You will have no. It's not by point totals. It's subjective in a sense, but I'll tell you, all 10 of the best players are Hall of Famers. So I'm not getting I'm not getting cute with any of this. These are all well known, famous star players. You have 10 seconds. This is basically your ability to think of these players as quickly as you can. I have no idea how it's going to work. You guys might go 10 for 10 easily, or it might be more challenging, but I encourage the listeners to play along. And I have not used anybody from the article last week, because I know both you guys read my stuff religiously.
Close that window.
Yep. Okay. So, this is...
you fucking...
But other than that, yeah, you're good. So,
all right.
Yeah, that's...
Point of order.
Yep.
Nick, how are we handling nicknames? Is New Zealand NL?
Let's say whatever their most common playing name was. Okay. You know, whatever they were named. Yeah, you go ahead. I don't think that's going to come up, though. Who wants to go first?
I mean, Ryan probably won the last quiz, so you can kick or receive.
I'll receive.
So Ryan's going first? Okay. Ryan, your player, who I think is probably the second best player I could find with these initials, and you'll have, after I say the name, you'll have 10 seconds.
Got it.
Player's name is Scott Young.
Steve Yzerman.
Correct.
Yeah.
All right. So there you go. Nice and simple.
I'm going to fucking lose this game pretty spectacularly.
Well, let's find out. Like I said, you guys could sweep the table, but I'm hoping the pressure will get to you. If you guys are killing it, I may reduce the time just to put artificial pressure on you. But, Greg, you ready for your first player?
No, but go ahead.
Your player is Scott Mellenby.
Steve Moore.
No. And that is time. First of all, I can't believe you didn't get the SM. I mean, come on, like this, the initials of the kit. No, Stan Mikita is who we're looking for.
Oh, yeah. On that one. There it is.
Ryan.
Yeah, it's.
Yeah.
Yes, Greg? You have something to share with us?
I have nothing to add.
Ryan, your player, Sergei Nemchinov.
Mm-hmm.
2 seconds.
Scott Niedermeyer.
Got it.
Yeah, baby. Wow.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Sniped it.
I would have gone Stan Nutcash, but that's cool.
So you, a Devils fan, wouldn't have come up with Scott Niedermeyer?
No, I probably would.
We might be able to wrap this up right now, I think, if this is... All right. Greg, your next guy is a very well-known name. He's one of my very favorite media guys. Your player is Ray Ferraro.
Ray Ferraro. Mm-hmm.
2 seconds.
Rene Fasel.
Yeah, that's
Is he in as a builder?
That's the one. Rene Fasel is the best player. He was way better than Ray Ferraro. No, Ron Francis is who we were looking for.
Oh, yeah.
On that one. All right, Ryan. You are up, and your player is a guy who is... this guy's not in the Hall of Fame, although many people incorrectly think he should be. Your player is Paul Henderson.
Ugh. I mean, Mike Ruzzioni should be in at that point.
I don't know. I'm out.
That one was... We were looking for Phil Housley.
Oh, sure.
Oh, God, yeah.
I kept thinking Pierre Horsberg. Is that was his name, right?
Yeah, that's the guy. That was him. All right, so, Greg, you are trailing.
You know what part of my problem with this game is? My problem is
you're
that,
losing.
Like,
you're
the
you're
one
getting your ass kicked
it.
In it.
Well, that, I mean, that's a problem too, but like, I'm like, my mind is been calibrated to try to think of like obscure, like 1950s and 60s players exactly. That you might be trying to ask about, but like, you're asking about guys that literally went in the Hall of Fame
super
yesterday.
Super famous
so
dudes. Yeah.
And I'm really fucking thrown by this.
And I'm trying to recalibrate your brain so that when I come back to these super obscure guys, in next week, you'll be all messed up.
All right,
Greg. This is your third. You're 0 for 2. You kind of need this one to stay in the running. But all right, here we go. This is a guy who's near and dear to my heart, former Leaf, Frederick Modine.
Frederick Modine.
Two seconds.
So I could think of is the word Fred, but I don't know who another Fred would be.
It's not a Fred.
Clearly. Yeah, I have no idea.
All right. We were looking for Frank Mihaljevic there.
Oh, fuck it. Fuck you. You know, we just got done talking about how I'm thinking about old players, and you're like, oh, no, they're fucking old. And then now you give me an old
obscure
player.
I mean, I feel like Frank Mihaljevic is probably not a super
sakes
obscure player, but maybe not. Ryan, you ready to wrap this up?
I just want to point out the inherent disadvantage I have that it's not even 9 o'clock in the morning, my time yet. To be able to do this
That's
game.
Fair.
You can tell Greg's losing because he's bringing up time zones.
Typical East Coast bias. All right.
Also, I drink a lot, and so maybe I don't have the same memory that other people have.
Maybe.
That too.
Should have been drinking right now. It might have helped.
Well, that's so true. One beer at Bar Trivia, and I am like fucking Ken Jennings. It's great.
Ryan, you can wrap this up right here.
All right, let's go.
So your player is an active player, but I don't think he's on track to take the crown. So your player is James Neal.
Hmm.
2 seconds.
I don't know.
John
Niedermeyer.
Niedermeyer.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. No, you were close. You were looking for Joe Nieuwendyk on that one.
Oh, sure.
Wow. Yeah.
All right, Greg, you ready to get one more wrong, and then we'll be done?
Yeah, I am very much ready. My body is ready.
This guy's probably of his initials, has, I think, the most famous wife, but was not the best player. Your player is
my wife.
Brooks Like.
Brooks Like?
Yep.
Okay. B.L.
Very good.
Brian Leach!
He got one.
Oh, my God!
Congratulations,
yes! On that.
All right, you know what? This is still, we're heading into the last round
game
here, and this is still a going concern. I mean, this could. All right, Ryan's got a chance to wrap it up here. And
it took me 5 seconds to not think about Brad Lukovic, but I finally got it.
All right, you ready, Ryan?
Yeah.
Your player is Eric Bélanger.
Ed Belfour.
He's got it. There it is.
Yeah. There it is. All right. There it is. Boy.
I did appreciate
it. I made it interesting, right?
Just for fun, Greg, your player would have been David Perron. Would you have gotten anywhere with that?
Probably like someone named Doug.
Not actually, surprisingly. But that would have been a good place to start. No, we would have been looking for Denny Potvin on that one. So.
Oh, yeah.
Probably wouldn't have mattered. But
so basically, I won game five of a series.
Yeah, a gentleman.
I won game four, and he won in game five. Yeah,
and you made everybody fly back for like another road game.
But yeah. I won game four like 6-1 and chased his goalie.
I mean,
and
if,
there was some real concern for
if
a second.
Yelling Brian Leetch over and over again. Then yes, I will count that as a blowout. But Ryan still takes the crown on this one.
It's almost like someone asked me who's the best defenseman in Leafs history, and I just started screaming Brian Leetch, Brian Leetch, Brian Leetch over and over again.
There you go.
All right, we'll end this episode, as we often do, with a real quick round of overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite. Our topic this week comes from Stan the Man, and the topic is Tom Cruise movies in honor of the Vulture Q&A with Thandi Newton, in which he talks about how Tom Cruise got so stressed out while making Mission Impossible 2 that a giant zit formed on his nose during the filming of a particular scene. Overrated Tom Cruise movie, Ryan Lambert.
Top Gun.
Damn.
It's fine.
Right to it, huh?
It's barely an action movie. Same with Days of Thunder, as a matter of fact. But, yeah.
Overrated Tom Cruise movie, Sean.
I gotta say, first of all, putting aside all the weird stuff, Tom Cruise is like one of my all-time favorite actors, and
absolutely
has one of the highest hit, like one of the highest hit rates of any actor that I can think of. So this is thinking of like poorly rated one. So we're on the overrated. You know which one I didn't love that could have been good, could have been a lot of fun, and really kind of wasn't, is Days of Thunder. I just feel like that had some potential there, like Top Gun, but race cars, and mm-hmm. It didn't really get there.
People do dig it. It's part of the Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer of Ovier, I believe. Overrated for me, Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow, for one reason, which is that I feel like people saw that movie coming out and were like, this is going to royally suck. And then it wound up being pretty good. And now it's been pushed as like an all-timer sci-fi movie that deserves a sequel and shit like that. Emily Blunt's real good in it. I think playing against type and her performance gets a little bit overpraised because of that too. I like the flick. I think it doesn't really end all that well.
No, it does not.
I think it's been really... really overrated based on just what the expectations were when it came out.
It's one of those classic movies where it's like, you have me on the premise. It's a war, and this one guy dies every time he is...
Yeah.
And that's it.
It's a great high-concept movie, yeah. But I just feel like its execution is being upheld to be at a standard that I don't think it reached.
I thought it was great, but I take your point that, you know, is it a 10 out of 10 masterpiece... like it sometimes gets portrayed, maybe not.
It's a B+.
Yeah.
It's a B+.
Yeah. Underrated Tom Cruise movie, Ryan.
I mean, I think one that doesn't get discussed very often, but which is really good, is Collateral.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Collateral's awesome.
That one is, that's fantastic.
First time he's really playing like an out-and-out villain, I feel like. Mm-hmm. Jamie Foxx is fucking great in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's awesome. Who directed that? Is that
That was Michael Mann.
It was Michael Mann. Yeah, that's a big part of the reason why it's good. Michael Mann rules.
Yeah. And famous for being one of the first movies that was sort of digitally shot as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, really great flick. Underrated Tom Cruise.
I'm gonna say this movie I don't think is underrated in terms of like by critics. But it's maybe underrated in the sense that some people still haven't seen it. Some people, maybe it doesn't rise right to the top of the Tom Cruise canon. But it's one of my favorite movies of all time, Minority Report.
It's great.
Excellent. Just fantastic, start to finish, great performance, great concept. Even the ending, which it's one of those movies you're three quarters of the way through and you're like, I'm loving this, but I have a bad feeling the ending is going to suck. The ending mostly works given what they were working with. I just really, and there's just so many shots in like the scene in the mall with the balloons and that, like it's just, I really enjoy them.
I think you have a point for it being underrated in the sense that I think of the two movies that he made with Spielberg that were both sci-fi, that War of the Worlds probably gets a lot more attention than Minority Report did.
I think it's a good example of like it came out in like I want to say the early 2000s.
Oh, two,
this was
maybe
right around
Minority Report. Yeah, it came out in 02.
This was right around the era where we were starting to learn that like original movies and as well as sci-fi that didn't have like an obvious tie-in to something already, it seemed to struggle to like break through as it did well. Lots of people saw it, but. It was a big hit, but it probably should have been an even bigger hit if it had something, you know, and War of the Worlds being an example of something where there was, even though the IP is like 80 years old at that point, people still are like, oh, I know that thing, and it turns into a bigger, maybe a bigger impact.
I've got two, and one is going to be my favorite, maybe, so I'll save that one. So I'll go underrated as The Firm.
It's really good.
John Grisham's book, one of the few times, cause I was young when this came out, like this came out like 93. And I remember, I didn't read The Firm, but The Firm was so good that I then read The Pelican Brief before that movie came out. It's real good. It's got an amazing supporting cast, like Wilford Brimley playing a fucking villain.
It's so good. Oh my god.
Gene Hackman, like it's a really solid potboiler legal thriller with a bit of sort of like he for those who don't know, he's a young lawyer who ends up working for a law firm that's a front for the mob. And it's good. It's really, really, really good.
Yeah, it's
great performance. It's and he's good in
really,
it.
Really, really good. I will say this though, those like early to mid '90s John Grisham movies are almost universally really fucking good. I think The Chamber is fine, but like Pelican Brief, The Client, A Time to Kill, The Rainmaker, awesome. They're all really fucking good.
They don't make a lot of movies like that anymore. Like at that big movie star Courtroom. Like that's. I wish they.
Well, and that was part of a lawyers as dashing conflicted heroes genre because you also had what the fuck was that movie like? Was it Presumed Innocent? Was around that time too?
Oh, there's a ton of movies. That was a huge thing because, and I think maybe because of you would say L.A. Law really kickstarted that. Because when was that? Yeah. When was L.A. Law like?
That was in the 90s, ladies, too. Yeah. Yeah, you're and, you know.
86 to 94.
All around that time, too. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
Favorite Mission Impossible movie, Lambert? Because I assume that's what
Of course it is. And the answer is the most recent one. Mission Impossible Fallout is a perfect fucking action movie. It's so good. I've seen it probably 10 times by now. But, like, you could say Rogue Nation. You could say Ghost Protocol. You could even say One, and I think the only two lesser entries in the series, which are still perfectly good, is 2 and 3. But yeah, I cannot get enough of the Mission Impossible series. I think they're the pound for pound the best movie franchise ever.
Wow.
On a per movie basis, what's better?
I mean, Hellraiser, but...
Okay, you know whatever. What? You're right.
Sean, favorite?
One that's another one that's in the running for my very favorite movie of all time is A Few Good Men. I just love that movie.
Really good.
So many times. And not necessarily his greatest performance. Obviously, he isn't the best performance in the movie, but that's part of it, right? Like, he goes into this movie, Jack Nicholson's, you know, got this, like, scene-chewing... And Tom Cruise could have gone in and said, I'm going to out Jack Nicholson, and the whole thing wouldn't have worked. And he doesn't. And it plays out perfectly, and, you know, the courtroom... Not just courtroom scenes. The whole movie is fantastic. It's... I'm not one of those guys who has a long list of movies that if I see it on TV, I'm going to just burn the afternoon watching it, but that is one of them for me. I love that movie.
I agree, and I also think that, to your point, it is sort of an underrated aspect that he makes you believe that he has to get to that point as a character where he can take on Nicholson in that scene, and he certainly isn't there for a lot of that movie, but he gets there, and I think that's a lot in the performance.
He is an unbelievably good actor. Like, he is
tremendous.
He doesn't get enough credit. Oscar wins. I think only 3 nominations, right? So
he was nominated for Jeremy
Maguire.
Born on the 4th of July.
Born on the 4th of July, and maybe.
Yeah, and he got supporting for Magnolia.
That's right. That, he didn't get it for Rain Man, but like that was clearly his Tom first. Cruise, yeah.
The thing with Tom Cruise for me is. Probably even from, like, the 80s with, like, Top Gun and that, but, like, certainly once the 90s comes along and he does Jerry Maguire and he does that, like, this guy could have coasted so easily and just made tens of millions of dollars making every action movie, every, you know, whatever, and he's done so much, like, weird stuff, like clearly is the guy who, like, makes movies he wants to make instead of just doing the easy paycheck thing that, frankly, a lot of actors would probably do in that same scenario. So,
but it's also the Harrison Ford problem, where he makes everything he does look so effortless that, you know, doing what he does in an action movie isn't considered to be acting when it should be, because like he makes it believable and he's really fucking good at that.
Well, I mean, it's definitely the thing of, you know, when he wanted to do the helicopter stunt for Mission Impossible, he was like, well, I'm going to be flying the helicopter, fucking obviously. And they were
of
like,
of course, right, yeah.
This is only for pilots that are rated, you know, whatever the rank is. And he was like, okay, what do I need to do to be that pilot then? And they were like, well, you would have to do X, Y, and Z. And he's like, okay, that's fine.
Yep.
And like the famous story is that he would like arrive to set every day flying that helicopter, because that way he would get the hours in that he needed to get in. And it's like, that's the only way I'm going to make this movie, is if I get to fly on the outside of an airplane. And it's like that, like, you know, you can say he has a death wish, and I think that might be, there's like a pretty credible thing to that.
Well, he also knows how many thetans he has, so when he gets reunited with Xenon,
well,
that he's,
you know,
be in good shape.
I just, this is a podcast I've only recently started listening to, but Blank Check is real. It's a great podcast, but they just did an episode on the first Mission Impossible movie, and Tom Cruise is older now than, you know, John Voight, who's portrayed as old and washed up in the first Mission Impossible movie. Tom Cruise is older now than John Voight was when they made that movie.
That's incredible.
And it's like, yeah, Tom Cruise is going to do this forever. He's going to die on the set of a Mission Impossible movie. And, like, we just have to accept that. And, like, that, it, like,
right.
Maybe you say that's not necessarily acting, but, like, it's not acting.
But also, we have to accept that that's when he gets his Oscar, per Heath Ledger rules.
He could have gotten one for any of the last 3 Mission Impossible movies, and I would have been fine with it. He's an incredible actor doing incredible work. And this is the classic actor as auteur kind of a series. So,
Sure. My favorite 3 Mission Impossible movies are Fallout, Ghost Protocol, and the first one. I think Ghost Protocol is my favorite one, and I think the best one, because I think it marries the intricate plotting and cool shit from what I think is a very Bond movie in Fallout with the complete over-the-top stuff from the first one. But I got to tell you, man, like, the first one is one of my most rewatchable movies. That's a movie where I will fucking get hooked in.
It's insanely good.
It's so entertaining.
Does it make any sense at all? No, it definitely doesn't.
But I still think that despite all of the shit that's come after it, like, there is no better set piece than the infiltration of the computer terminal in Langley when he's dangling from the ceiling. Like, I think that's, like, maybe the best action set piece in the history of movies as far as, like, building of tension, and Brian De Palma does an incredible job shooting it, and, you know, all the pieces that are working where the what's-her-face is squirting the shit juice in the guy's coffee.
Yeah, and like, he has to catch the drop of sweat. Like, they do so much work to establish the rules of this insane room that, like, couldn't exist.
And they never break them.
And they never
break them once. They break him once because I think when he's being dragged up, it would have made enough noise to set off the alarm.
Oh, maybe,
But it's perfect.
Yeah, the other thing to say, obviously, is like, I don't know, like the Halo jump scene in 7. Climbing the Burj Khalifa, I think, is probably the number one action set piece because, again, this dude was like, oh, I'm just going to do that. And they were like, well, you can't do that. And he's like, sure I can. And then he did it.
You did it. All right. Least favorite. You can go, Ryan.
I mean, he hasn't done a lot of duds, you know? I guess you would say one of the earlier ones, like Legend, maybe. Like, there are some...
yes.
But, like, I don't know. The only one I can think of that, like, is even in the 21st century that isn't particularly good is Lions for Lambs, and he's only in that for, like... He's not in that very much. I don't seem to recall. Maybe he is. I saw it once and hated it. But yeah, let's go with Legend. Why not?
I'm like Ryan. I struggle with this just because there aren't a lot of bad movies here. But I'm gonna use the phrasing of the question, which I think we're doing Tom Cruise movies, not Tom Cruise roles. So I'm gonna say. Yeah. My least favorite is the movie Rock of Ages.
Yeah, sure.
It's the rock musical, and so I'll say two things on that. First of all, one of the most fun nights I've ever had was in Vegas watching that live show, just getting completely hammered and just watching it like play out live. Like it's phenomenal. I don't know if it's still running. It probably is, but once people can go back to Vegas, check that out. I highly recommend it. So I was eager to see the movie. And the movie just doesn't work. Maybe it couldn't possibly work.
It's a dud, yeah.
But Tom Cruise basically playing Axl Rose in a musical, phenomenal. And not only that, but just the fact, like the whole time you're just like, why is he even doing this movie? Why would he agree to do this? But again, he just goes all in, and by the end of it, you're like, I was watching the movie like, I want Stacey Jacks on the screen. And I'll watch that, and everything else I want to skip past because none of the rest of it is working. But this guy just goes all, like he doesn't. There's this thing that happens in bad movies all the time where you can pinpoint the moment where the big star realizes it's a bad movie and is like, "I'm mailing it in. I'm done. I'm just gonna cash my paycheck and get out of here. No one's gonna see this, and we'll never speak of it again."
Tom Cruise does not have that gear.
Yeah, no.
He just goes all, and it's phenomenal. If somebody made like a cut of just like all the Stacey Jack scenes and nothing else, and it would be like a 20-minute movie because it's not a huge role, that would be worth watching.
You guys are both right, but I have to say my choice is The Mummy that came out in the last couple of years. It's a fucking terrible movie.
It's not good.
And was one of those things where like one of the worst things about the Marvel Cinematic Universe is the way that it tried to create it made all these other studios try to create their
own
universes.
Yeah, it was going to be like this monster universe, right? Like
it was going to be the dark universe. Johnny Depp playing, I think, the Invisible Man.
Russell Crowe is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Benicio del Toro.
Javier Bardem was going to play the Wolfman.
Oh, right. Benicio del Toro played the Wolfman in, like, 2006, maybe?
It's a terrible movie just doesn't do anything to establish a large... It's fucking bad. And the best thing that came out of the movie was that clip of... Of the Tom Cruise and like flying around in a being thrown around a plane, and they just had the raw audio of it of people going ugh,
yeah,
ah, ooh, with no other effects. It was tremendous. You can find it. All right, that's the show. Thanks for listening. Usual marathon effort. Yeah. Thanks. You read my stuff on ESPN. You can listen to ESPN on Ice. Me and Emily this week talked with Billy Guerin of the Minnesota Wild about a great many things, and also Rick Westhead about all the shit that that he covers, which is uniformly scary. Lambert?
Yeah, sign up for the Puck Soup Patreon. I got the newsletter. We're not doing Mise en Pod anymore, but as Greg said, all the episodes are on there, and we're probably going to do like a classic season at some point as well. Kind of going to get busy in the next little while here, I feel like, but yeah, we'll come back to that. And then me and Sean Gentile do Stick to Sports once a month, and it's everybody's favorite podcast about breakfast cereal and Blink-182. So that's it.
Nice. Find me on The Athletic. I wrote a piece this week, if you're a Leafs fan, on the oral history of The Passion Returns, which is the greatest VHS tape in hockey history. And if you're a Leafs fan of a certain age, you probably got a copy for Christmas in 1993 and watched it 100 times. And you can find the behind-the-scenes stories on how this thing got made, as well as the completely bizarre and impossible Glenn Anderson led music video that that went along with it, and what the hell people were thinking participating in that.
All right, thanks everybody for listening, much appreciated, and support the Patreon, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
See you.
Bye bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons, we've got sportly commentary to what if you commute. We also cover movies, TV shows, hits, and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Puck Soup.